Today's sermon in our series, The Struggle is Real, and we are on to the third part. Many thanks to Mike for stepping in last week and taking the reins for me. The title this week is It Has to Be the Hedge, and you will understand that as we step forward through the sermon this morning together. Just a reminder that this series is intended to remind us that there is a real struggle going on, that there are real spiritual forces of evil in this world. Ephesians chapter 6, verse 12 reminds us that that is where our struggle is, not against flesh and blood, but against the spiritual forces of evil that exist in this world. So this series looks at those instances in Scripture where we actually explicitly see Satan at work, where we see evil manifested clearly, and we're going to be asking the question, what does it look like in these instances where we see evil manifested so clearly? And I think we're going to continue to be surprised, because the pictures we have in our brains of what it looks like when Satan and evil are manifested may not match up with some of the things we discover the Bible actually says about those things. So, without any further ado, we're going to be studying Job today, the story of Job. Andy already alluded to it, so if you have a Bible and you want to follow along there, you can open it up. We are just going to barely scratch the surface. The book of Job is old, long, and complicated. And I say this a lot, but someday I want to preach a series through the entire book. Listen, that will take a long time. There is so much going on in the book of Job. Today we're just going to look at some of the first two chapters of Job's story and ask the questions, when we see Satan active and manifested, what does it actually look like? So we're going to start with just verses 1 through 5. We'll start there and we're going to continue on in the story as we move forward. But Job 1, 1 through 5, reads like this. In the land of Uz, there lived a man whose name was Job. This man was blameless and upright. He feared God and he shunned evil. He had 7 sons and 3 daughters. He owned 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 donkeys, and he had a large number of servants. He was the greatest man among all the people of the East. His sons used to hold feasts in their homes for their birthdays, and they would invite their 3 sisters to eat and to drink with them. And when a period of feasting had run its course, Job would make arrangements for them to be purified. Early in the morning, he would sacrifice a burnt offering for each of them, thinking, perhaps my children have sinned and cursed God in their hearts. This was Job's regular custom. So in a moment, we're going to get into the activity of Satan. But let's just take a brief time to do a quick character sketch of Job, so we can understand him a little bit more deeply than just his name, before digging into it. So here are the things I observed, a little character sketch of Job. Here's the first one. Job was a morally pure, wise, and obedient man. Right off the top, you read it. Blameless and upright. He feared God, which according to Proverbs, the fear of God is the beginning of wisdom. So he's a very wise man. He's an obedient man, right? He fears God. He shuns evil. He's morally pure, wise, and obedient. Job also was blessed with a large, large family. Did you catch the numbers? 7, right? 7 sons and 3 daughters, which if you're familiar with the Hebrew scriptures at all and the way they use numbers sometimes, those numbers are for completeness. There's a wholeness. Job not only has a big family, it's like a big perfect family. And in some ways, Psalm 127 reminds us that many children are like a quiver full of arrows. And I would argue that Job's is so full of arrows he can barely carry it slung over his shoulder. He has like the ideal perfect big family blessing situation. And then there's this. Thirdly, Job was absolutely loaded. Absolutely loaded, right? Now, anybody recognize this? This is old school, right? Right? Scrooge McDuck. Although I've heard they've remade this, I think, on Netflix maybe, which, just total side note, but we have a television movie industry that, I mean, billions of dollars And they cannot come up with one single new idea. They just keep figuring things that they're going to remake over and over again. But if you know anything about Scrooge McDuck, you know that he is absolutely a wealthy man. Job was an absolutely loaded guy. Now, we don't really see it so much in the text because we see a list of animals, right? A list of animals. What was it? 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen. I read that and I'm like, I don't want any part of a farm that big. All that is scooping a bunch of mess all the time and trying to keep animals happy. But here's the thing. When we read that in the context of Job, we need to understand that those are symbols in his day for piles and piles and piles of money you could ski down. Think of names like these. Bill Gates, Elon Musk, Mark Zuckerberg, Jeff Bezos, the most wealthy people on the planet. Job is one of those people. Morally pure, upright, blessed with a huge family, hugely wealthy. And then there's this one. Job was benevolent, conscientious, and sacrificial. How do we know this? Because his kids would have parties for their birthdays. I'm betting big parties because they had the means to do it. And then these parties would run their course. And Job was so conscientious of what might have happened at these parties, even in the hearts of his children, that he would get up early and sacrifice for them in order to offer a sacrifice to God in case they had offended God. Now, we're not going to take up the question now whether you can actually do that, make sacrifices for someone else to that's a discussion for another time, but that's the kind of person Job was. So why do we dig into all that? For me to say this, isn't it true, by looking at this list of things, that Job seems like the last man in the world that deserves to have something bad happen? Job should be at the bottom of any list for people who deserve to suffer. But if you know anything about the story of Job, you know what's coming next. We'll pick it up in verse 6. One day the angels came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came with them. And the Lord said to Satan, "Where have you come from?" Satan answered the Lord, "From roaming throughout the earth, going back and forth on it." Then the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? There is no one like him on earth. He is blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil." "Does Job fear God for nothing?" Satan replied. "Have you not put a hedge around him and his household and everything he has? You've blessed the work of his hands so that his flocks and herds are spread throughout the land. But now stretch out your hand and strike everything he has, and he will surely curse you to your face." The Lord said to Satan, "Very well then. Everything he has is in your power, but on the man himself do not lay a finger." And then Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. So early on in Job's story, we start to read some things that kind of make us go, huh? This is one of them. Why is Satan permitted this audience with God along with all of the other angels, right? Did somebody like not check him at the gate? He somehow snuck through? Was there a back entrance? Why is Satan even present in this heavenly court, in this audience with God? I don't know. I'm going to ask several questions this morning I don't have answers to. I hope that doesn't bother you. If it does, you're just going to have to live with it. So keep this in mind, though. The word Satan in Hebrew, when it's accompanied by the word the, which in this context it is, the word is adversary, and it has roots in the idea of an accuser. The adversary and the accuser. Ha-Satan, the Satan, the accuser, the adversary. Which is exactly what we see Satan doing here in this passage. Right? Indeed. So, there's this audience with God. And Satan is asked where he is coming from. And he gives an answer that gives us sort of one of the learning points for this morning. The spiritual forces of evil are not contained in some sort of deep pit at the center of the earth. They're roaming throughout the earth, going back and forth on it. I think when we picture Satan and evil and all of Satan's minions, we picture them sort of bound up in this steamy, hot area surrounded by magma somewhere near the core of the actual earth. But when God says to Satan, "Where have you come from?" that's not the answer. The answer is from roaming. Here and there and everywhere about the face of the earth. I think it's easier and more convenient to believe in a Satan and evil that's down there, away from us. But that's not what we actually learn from Scripture. Then we get to a second part that confuses me. It almost seems to me, anyway, that God is almost volunteering Job. Have you met Job? He's a great guy. Upright, blameless, right? Almost like the way a teacher talks about a star student. Have you seen this kid? All A's, 100% on everything. Test scores off the roof. Or how a coach talks about a star athlete. Have you seen the kid run the ball, hit the ball? Amazing. I don't have answers for all these, but doesn't it seem like God is sort of using Job as bait? Like baiting Satan into this thing, and Job is the bait in this situation? I don't know. I read these things, and it jumps off the page at me. But then we get to Satan's response. God says, have you met Job? And Satan says, yeah, he's obedient. He's upright. He's morally pure. He's a great guy. But do you know why? It has to be the hedge. That's why. You put a hedge around him, around his family, around his stuff. If you take that hedge away, he will turn around. He will curse you, and he will walk away. A reminder of this truth. See, because Satan says it can't be as it seems. The spiritual forces of evil want us to see all things, and especially the most positive things, through the lens of cynicism. And we're going to camp out here for a bit, so get comfortable in this idea of cynicism and how dangerous it is. Because if I were asked you to list for me the top 10 or top 20 most powerful manifestations of evil in the world, I don't think cynicism would make the list. It's this minor thing that's somewhat annoying, right? But I'm going to argue this morning that cynicism is one of the most powerful manifestations of the spiritual forces of evil in our world. So what does it mean, first of all? To be cynical means this: believing that people are motivated by self-interest or distrustful of human sincerity or integrity, or perhaps my favorite, contemptuously distrustful of human nature and motives. That is what it means to be cynical, to have cynicism. And with all of that said, I would argue this very simple point. Cynicism prohibits us from believing the best about other people. Being cynical prohibits us from seeing the best or even anything good in other people. I'll give you an example. I have an article that I actually saved on my phone months ago, and I didn't know why at the time, except for the fact that it was really, really interesting to me and depressing at the same time. But now I know, getting to the sermon, why I saved it for such a time as this, as they say. So here's why. It's an article that I read that focuses on a 2017 study of the political climate in the United States of America. And it reveals some really, really troubling things. The article begins with this line: you know what they really want. You know what they really want. And then goes on like this: as America slouches toward the 2020 presidential election, candidates and pundits will regularly tell you this. This line, you know what they really want. About the other political side, followed by a list of extremist beliefs, twisted motives, and wicked desires. And the article goes on to actually tell us that most of us don't actually accurately understand the other side anyway. We think we do, but we don't, right? But to me, this is the most convicting thing out of the whole article, and goes right into this idea of cynicism we're talking about right now this morning. Listen to this. Today, more than 90%, over 90% of both Republicans and Democrats, so this is an equal opportunity conviction. I don't care if you like donkeys or elephants. Doesn't matter to me. This is equally convicting to all of us, right? 90% of both Republicans and Democrats describe people in their own party with these words: honest, reasonable, and caring. Meanwhile, 80% of each party, 80%, 8 in 10 of each party describe the other side with these words: brainwashed and hateful. Now, you may look at me and go, Pete, this just It's just the climate that we live in. It's just the way things are done nowadays. I will tell you what it is. I will tell you clearly and plainly. It is satanic. It's satanic is what it is. Right? These attitudes and the words and actions that come from them are satanic because it is cynicism at its core. Right? And listen, friends, I expect this from the world. I do. I expect nothing better than tribalistic cynicism from the world. But as Christians, we have to be different. We must be. Are we different? We need to be different. And I would love to believe that this is only an in-the-world problem, but I don't think it is. And I don't think it is even in just this realm. This is going to be the end of my cynicism rant until 2:56 a.m. this morning. Here's what happened, and I have to unpack this for a while, so stay with me. At 2:56 this morning, I woke up, and I woke up from a dream that was extremely vivid and extremely bothersome. Now, here's why this is interesting. First of all, I don't dream. I mean, that's not like I don't have a dream. Like, I don't remember my dreams. Like, literally a dozen times a year, maybe, I will wake up either in the middle of the night or in the morning and remember what I've dreamed. I don't know if I have a sleeping disorder. I don't know if my brain just kicks to such a low gear when I'm asleep that it does nothing. I don't know. But I do not remember my dreams. So this is a really odd thing, right? And I also don't usually, I'm not affected by them when I do remember them. But I woke up from this dream and literally my heart was just thumping in my chest. I could feel it. And my gut was turned in so many knots, more knots than a hastily stowed string of Christmas lights, right? It was just, and so the dream, I'm not going to go into the details of it, but God allowed me to feel in that dream, and this is another thing. I've never been a big, like, dreams type person, but I really believe God allowed me to feel something in that dream that I learned about earlier that day. So now we've unpacked that. We're going to unpack this. Earlier on Saturday, my daughter had a soccer tournament. So we were in Poland. We were in, I mean, what's better than watching soccer in bone-chilling 50-degree rain, right? Not much better than that. The only saving grace is between games, we went to Chick-fil-A, and during the game, I held an umbrella in my hand and also propped up my phone so I could watch the Buckeyes totally destroy the Wisconsin Badgers. Don't worry, I didn't totally miss it, right? But in between games, we ate and we came back and we had time. We're sitting in the car, and my wife says to me, "Did you see that video, that link that I sent a while back?" I said, "No, I heard about it. I'd heard enough about it. I actually didn't want to hear about it. I don't think I want to see it." She's like, "No, you need to see this." And why I had not dug into it, I don't know, but now I know because of the timing that I needed for this experience. So, and the video was pertaining to, I'll give you all the details later if you want to see all these things, but essentially there was a conference-y type thing that was happening, and there were some Christian leaders on a platform being asked questions in sort of an interview style, word association type thing. I'm not going to name names because I just don't want to. But the question was this. It was about Beth Moore, right? Beth Moore, very, very popular, well-regarded teacher, preacher, things like that. And so these men on the platform were asked about Beth Moore and what word association would you have with her? And the first gentleman, his answer was simply two words, "Go home." And then it got worse from there, believe it or not. Now, I'm not going to get into the whole doctrinal differences. Like, there are some churches that for a long time have believed that women do not have roles as preachers for this reason, that reason, and they use scripture to back it up and things like that. I'm not going to get into that whole debate today. I don't have time. I don't have the desire. No, actually, I will say one thing. I will say that I passionately disagree with the opinions that are shared. I am so thankful and proud to be a part of a denomination, a tradition, a movement that from its very inception said that the voices of women matter. And they matter a lot. And that they have a role to play. And I could give you a bucket full of scripture to tell you why I believe that, but I'll just give you one. And I think it should be enough. The first recorded preachers in the history of Christianity were women. The women that stood at the foot of the cross, watched Jesus die, were with him through thick and through thin, and then days later walked to what they thought was a grave still containing his body to continue to minister to him, found that the tomb was empty, returned to the disciples who were too scared to go anywhere on their own, and simply said, "He is risen." And that was the first sermon, and really those were the best sermons. So I disagree passionately. And we can disagree about these things, but then if you watch the video, they just absolutely belittled this woman, who wasn't there to defend herself. Belittled her, questioned her ministry, her voice, poked fun at her, belittled her character, said she was a narcissist, and literally used the phrase that I just used. You know what they really want. These women who want to preach, you know what they really want. They don't really want equality. What they really want is power. And I watched that video and then I reread the sermon and I thought, we're doing no better. We're doing no better. We have to do better. We cannot let the powerful influence of cynicism and the evil spiritual nature it brings with it have a place in our churches. We can't. Our witness in the world is too important. Okay, I think I'm done. Sorry about that. I get a little bit. I tell you, I don't preach here 1 week, and I get crazy. I don't know. I'm a hot mess right now. So it's been a long weekend. It's been an emotional anyway. So Satan manifests the cynicism. God seems to push back. Now, God, I want you to make a note of this. And if I were to preach the whole book of Job, we'd get into it deeply. God doesn't actually do anything to Job. But God, it looks like, allows a level of access to Job that had been previously denied Satan. And he says, go ahead. If you think it's the hedge, let's take the hedge away and see what happens. And then Job experiences what I would call a tornado of suffering. And I say a tornado of suffering because of what that picture brings forth. I brought a picture of a crazy tornado. But because it happens so suddenly and so violently, right? I'm not going to go back and read all of it, but here's what happens. Job is informed in quick succession that all of these things have happened. First, he was robbed by one of his rivals and enemies. They took oxen and donkeys and killed some of the servants. And then more sheep and servants were burned alive by fire that fell from heaven. And then camels were stolen from him by another rival enemy, and more servants were lost to the sword. And then a mighty wind blew in from the desert and struck his eldest son's home while all of his children were inside, eating and drinking and celebrating, and all of them died. Job lost everything, and if you read the narrative, it happens like this. Boom, boom, boom. He loses it all in quick fire suffering. And we read in verse 22, though, that Job did not sin by charging God with wrongdoing. Which leads me to this conclusion. The spiritual forces of evil want to entice you to accuse God as the author of your suffering. And I want to tell you today to remind you, he is not. God is not the author of your suffering. Now, is there mystery in what happens to Job and what happens to us? Absolutely. I think the mystery we really can't solve. But God is not the author of your suffering. Now, the spiritual forces of evil, they want you to cross that bridge, to point that finger, to make that accusation that God is the author of the suffering that you experience. But he is not. And if you think, wow, that's a crazy story, it can't get any worse. Well, to borrow a phrase from really bad infomercials, but wait, there's more. Picking it up in Job chapter 2, verse 3. Then the Lord said to Satan, "My servant Job still maintains his integrity, though you enticed me against him to ruin him without any reason." "Skin for skin," Satan replied. "A man will give all he has for his own life. But now stretch out your hand and strike his flesh and bones, and he will surely curse you to your face." The Lord said to Satan, "Very well then, he's in your hands, but you must spare his life." So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and afflicted Job with painful sores from the soles of his feet to the crown of his head. And then Job took a piece of broken pottery and scraped himself with it as he sat among the ashes. And his wife said to him, "Are you still maintaining your integrity? Curse God and die." And he replied, "You are talking like a foolish woman. Shall we accept good from God but not trouble?" And in all of this, Job did not sin in what he said. What a powerful picture of Job sitting in the ashes. Scholars are divided whether they were purposeful ashes, because that's part of the mourning process in Jewish culture, was to actually have ashes involved. Some scholars suggest that these were actually ashes from the eldest son's house that had just burned down, and that's all that was left. And there Job sits in the middle of the ashes. Satan's last gasp, then, is to afflict Job's health. Well, if you remove the hedge from everything else, remove it from his health, and he will then certainly curse you to your face. And so that's where we find Job, struck with sores from the top of his head to the bottom of his feet. And that part that really got me this week is that he was scraping his skin with a broken piece of pottery. I don't know that there's a better way to express what Job was going through in that moment than that picture. Scholars say that most likely the reason he was scraping his skin with that broken piece of pottery is that his sores, his boils, whatever you want to call them, not to get too gross, were probably so full of like pustule material that he was trying to clean out his wounds by scraping himself with a broken piece of pottery while he sat among the ashes. How crazy is that scene? Job sitting in the ashes. Which leads me to this question. Have you metaphorically ever felt like Job felt in that moment? Have you ever felt like you were sitting in the ashes of a life that you once knew? Because again, I think the Bible exists so that we can learn from it and look into our own lives and see God reflected there. Have you ever sat in the ashes, scraping at your own self, a life that you once knew now simply crumbled all around you? And the theme of this part of the passage, notice twice there's a reference to integrity. God says to Satan, have you seen Job? He maintains his integrity in the midst of everything. And then Job's wife walks by and says, "Are you still maintaining your integrity somehow? Just curse God and die." I think a reminder for us that the spiritual forces of evil threaten the integrity of our character. Now, integrity isn't just about being honest and being moral. To be in integrity, by definition, is to be in a state of wholeness, to be undivided in your personhood. Think of it this way, a way to sort of think of it outside of yourself. Probably you're familiar with the phrase structural integrity, right? When something does or does not have structural integrity. We apply that phrase to buildings, to bridges, to airplanes, right? When something is able to perform its function, when it's held together well, but when you start to see cracks and creases and crumbling, you're starting to lose it. I mean, how many of you would go and look at a property, look at a home, and notice that there is a lack of structural integrity and then still buy that building? Probably none of you, unless you plan to just tear it all down and start from scratch. Or how many of us, if we were sitting at the gate in an airport, heard an announcement that said, "Oh, the flight's about ready. There is some structural integrity problem with the aircraft, but you can go ahead and start boarding now." Anybody getting on that plane? Not a chance. Because integrity matters. Wholeness matters. And the spiritual forces of evil in the world want to attack your integrity of your character. To start with cracks and creases and crevices and crumblings. So if you've ever felt cracked, divided, or unwhole, there's potential that that's the enemy of your soul at work, attacking the integrity of your character. But then the last thing we see in this passage is that the spiritual forces of evil will try to rob you of hope. Job's wife walks by. She's a rather unhelpful character, if you ask me. She simply walks by. She knows everything that's happened to Job. She sees him sitting in the midst of the ashes, scraping his own skin. Doesn't offer to help him, right? But simply says, You're still maintaining your integrity? Just curse God and die. Just let it be done. And if we're honest, when we go through those moments and seasons and circumstances in life, when we feel like we're sitting in the ashes, those things pop into our minds as well. I just wish that this could be over and done. Which is why I want to close with a passage from Lamentations that was not muttered from Job's lips, but I think perfectly describes the situation Job is in. Lamentations chapter 3, verses 21 to 24. Yet this I call to mind, and therefore I have hope. Because of the Lord's great love, we are not consumed. For his compassions never fail. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. I say to myself, the Lord is my portion, and therefore I will wait for him. These words do not make everything magically better. They wouldn't have solved any of Job's in the ashes problems. But I believe in those moments when we are led to walk away from hope, to give up hope, these are the words that we cling to. That we may be beaten and battered and sitting in the ashes, but we are not consumed. That God's love, his great faithfulness is still with us. And we wait for him. So a few things to think about as we finish our time together to consider, to pray about, to pray on as we have a moment of silent reflection. Here's the first one. What sorts of people or groups of people do you tend to view through the lens of cynicism? Because I'm going to remind you one time, it's not a little thing. It is a satanic power in our world. And we need to do away with it. Secondly, have you ever been enticed to blame God for your suffering? Why or why not? Third, how is the integrity of your life holding up right now? Do you feel that you are whole and undivided in your character? And I would say, if prayerfully you consider, and the answer is no, obviously seek God that the Spirit can minister to you, but please seek out a brother or sister in Christ to share that with them so they can help you bear those burdens. And then lastly, if nothing else today, pray for someone you know who might be on the brink of losing hope, that they might sense the presence of God even in the suffering. And maybe that person's you. But if it's not you, if you know of someone that's sitting in the ashes, pray for them during this time, that God's presence, that his power would be manifested to them. So let's take a moment or two to pray. If you want to close your eyes, bow your head, you're welcome to, or just simply read through those words on the screen, and then after a moment of silence, I'll go ahead and pray to close it up.